and ethics, especially Catholic ethics, as it pertains to infertility. I'll be talking about IVF, NAPA technology, and then specific cases. Please don't hesitate to ask questions during this presentation. It might be a little bit technical, so please don't hesitate to stop me and ask questions. I will be discussing sexual ethics as they apply to women's health care. I don't see many, I guess, young kids here, and so I guess that's appropriate, but just a little disclaimer that it might not be appropriate for young kids. So intrauterine insemination, to start off with. This is a process widely used in infertility, whereby a woman's ovaries are often stimulated to make more than one egg. Sperm are then obtained through masturbation. Then they are washed, concentrated, and injected into the uterine cavity at the time of ovulation. It was originally developed to overcome cervical factor infertility. And what that means is, gosh, sometimes we think that the cervix doesn't make enough cervical mucus, or that mucus maybe doesn't mix well with the partner's sperm. And so that's how it was developed, to actually get the sperm past the cervix. They used to put the sperm right in the cervix, but found that, gosh, it seems to work better if we put it through the cervix into the uterus. As you can see here, this is a uterus and fallopian tubes and so forth. Cervical mucus is made here at the cervix. And again, sometimes sperm might, the theory is sperm have trouble getting through there. And so the idea was, okay, gosh, let's put the sperm right up in here to give them a better chance to reach the ovaries and the egg. And so here's just a diagram. Obviously, they obtain the sperm, they put a little catheter, and they put it through the cervix into the uterine cavity. So if you read textbooks about this, they talk about the cycle fecundity. That means the chance that in one cycle that a woman will have a live birth as a result of that. And they say, gosh, okay, the chance is about 3 to 10% when we use the man's sperm, if the man's sperm, there's some problem with it, if they're infertile. But if we use donor sperm from a different man, gosh, we can be more successful, up to 30% chance of live birth per cycle. And then they state that, gosh, success depends upon the sperm density and different factors. So the question is, gosh, does it really overcome cervical factor? And if you read these textbooks, they do a lot of studies regarding this. One study looked at intrauterine insemination, simply putting the sperm into the uterine cavity, versus just couples just having intercourse, and found that, gosh, both groups seemed roughly the same in terms of their success rate. Another study looked at, again, unstimulated IUI. That means not giving any other drugs, just putting the sperm through the cervix, and expected management, just having the couples have intercourse. Again, not much of a difference, not a difference that's statistically significant. That means, gosh, this small difference here is likely to be due to chance alone. And so Spiroff is one of the leading textbooks in infertility. It states that, gosh, the best available evidence suggests that treatment with intrauterine insemination for unexplained infertility has really no meaning. So why should we do it, for at least for the category of what they say is unexplained infertility? Now, any infertility physician you go to, they'll talk to their patients. They'll say, "Gosh, you know, your success rate's going to be not that high with no treatment. Intrauterine insemination, we can get, not that much better. But if we add some other drugs, we can get it higher. But really, you know, IVF is the best. So why don't you just do IVF?" That's, you know, every day women in offices are shown this chart here and what they should. And really, gosh, they're really just trying to push people up to IVF. Now, the ethics regarding intrauterine insemination. This is from Donum Vitae, one of the church documents in 1987, that reinforced that, gosh, new human life, we should give the dignity of new human life requires that it come from an act of love between man and wife. And this is what I'll be coming back to again and again, just to really drive this point home. So it says, gosh, there's a link between the procreation and the conjugal act and marriage. And so homologous artificial insemination within marriage, that means, gosh, intrauterine insemination between a husband and wife cannot be admitted except for those cases in which the technical means is not a substitute but serves to facilitate and to help so that the act attains its natural purpose. So this is kind of cloudy, at least in my opinion. And I don't know if any of you have heard this, but the church is basically saying that intrauterine insemination is not moral unless it assists the marriage act. Now, obviously, if we get the sperm through masturbation and just get it put in, obviously that the church says that's not right. But there are certain cases where you can say, gosh, well, what if we have a couple that's having intercourse with a perforated condom that's not contraceptive? We can get a sample of the sperm, we can clean that, and then we can push that up through into the uterine cavity. Might that be a incontinuity with the marriage act? So, you know, in deference to the church, obviously the church is very hesitant to make official blanket statements. I mean, they really want to make sure that they discern these moral issues. And so I know that individual theologians have opinions about this. I do myself. I feel like it does try to replace the marriage act. And I'll say so. But the church itself has not definitively ruled on that. And so I'm clear with my patients if they ask me about that. I don't think it really helps much, obviously, as the studies have shown, at least for unexplained infertility. And I'll have you click again on this. The latest church document in 2008 simply references Donum Vitae and says it's only moral if it serves to assist the marital act. So again, the church hasn't officially proclaimed on this, but myself and many other physicians and theologians do feel like it is not moral. So ART. ART stands for Assisted Reproductive Technologies. It's essentially, this means IVF. I mean, it's any technique that takes the eggs, the oocytes, out of a woman's body and seeks to manipulate them to make embryos and to transfer them back into the uterus. You know, there were different older kinds of manipulating the eggs and so forth, but now IVF is essentially the only one that physicians are using. So basically, this process works by obtaining human eggs from a woman's ovaries and then sperm through masturbation, combines them in a laboratory dish to create new embryos, which are then subjected to quality control and efficiency measures. Now they can do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where they'll look at those embryos and take a cell away from it and run tests to make sure it doesn't have a certain disease. After the embryos are created, they may be either discarded, thrown away if they look like they don't measure up, frozen for later use, or donated for research. So obviously you can see right there, gosh, this is a new human life, and we're treating it like a product. And we'll talk more about this in a couple minutes. There's just a little graphic representing what happens. Gosh, they stimulate a woman's ovaries to make maybe 10 eggs on each side. They take a needle and aspirate those eggs. And then they combine it with sperm in a dish. And these are, keep in mind, these are each new human lives here. Now, as I mentioned, of course, the embryos are then, if they measure up and seem like they're quality, they're instilled into a woman's uterus. They typically do 2 to 3 embryos in the hopes that at least one will implant in the lining successfully. However, sometimes all of them implants, or twinning could occur, that could lead to a high-risk multiple pregnancy, quadruplets, quintuplets, and so forth. Now, these pregnancies are very high risk. They can lead to preterm delivery. They can lead to a lot of medical problems for the woman. That's why many times the physicians will say, okay, well, we did get you pregnant, great, but you got pregnant with too many. So now you need to have a selective reduction, which is a euphemism for an abortion, so we can make your pregnancy into maybe a singleton pregnancy or a twin pregnancy in the hopes that you'll carry that pregnancy to term. So obviously, that doesn't need much explanation. It's pretty self-apparent that, gosh, we're just creating life to destroy it. So that's very frustrating and obviously very immoral just on the face of it. And again, just on the face of it, we can each imagine a number of different points. Gosh, it destroys human lives at their earliest stages when we're discarding embryos, just donating them for research and so forth. It weakens the institution of the family and leads to a lot of confusion. What is a parent? What if is it the surrogate mother who carries the embryo, or the donor egg, the sperm? I mean, what came from who, and who's my mom and dad? I mean, what a bunch of confusion here. Another apparent abuse is body parts for sale. Now, they all say, well, gosh, we need a volunteer egg donor. You know, we'll compensate you for your time with $20,000, but you're a volunteer, okay? So, I mean, that kind of leads to this thought of body parts for sale here. And with all the multiple pregnancies that this can cause, up to about 30 to 40% of IVF pregnancies are multiple pregnancies, twins, triplets, or higher. a lot of problem here with preterm delivery. The baby's coming out too early. Then they have to have a long stay in the neonatal intensive care unit, and they can have lifelong problems, pulmonary problems, neurologic problems that result. So it used to be that IVF was originally developed for tubal infertility. If the tubes were blocked, well, you can't conceive, so we'll put the embryo right in your cavity. Now, today's indications are simply just everybody. So we're going to look at some of the ethical considerations here. Obviously, the first consideration before we do anything should be, should I do this? Not, can I do this? Not, how great is technology? Not, how great is this? And, you know, all these celebrities are getting pregnant through this. No, it's the first question is, should I do this? This is from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Ethical and Religious Directives. And it acknowledges, gosh, biological sciences have advanced. While we rejoice in potential for the good inherent in these technologies, we cannot assume that what is technically possible is always morally right. If these substitute for the Marriage Act, they are not consistent with human dignity. When the marital act of sexual intercourse is not able to attain its procreative purpose, assistance that does not separate the unitive and procreative acts is moral and may be used to help couples conceive. And obviously, techniques that involve in the destruction of human embryos is not moral as well. So I gave this parts of this lecture to our OBGYN residents a couple weeks ago at St. Peter's. And I asked them, they had just heard like an IVF lecture from an IVF doctor. And so in my lecture, I said, okay, what are the limits of this IVF technology? You don't have good eggs? No problem. We'll get donor eggs from a totally different woman. I mean, don't worry. It's not your biological child, but don't worry about that. We'll get donor eggs that will work better. Oh, well, you can't carry the child yourself. You don't have a uterus or a problem? No problem. We'll get a surrogate mother. You don't even have to carry your child anymore. No problem. Don't worry. Okay, oh, your husband doesn't have good sperm. Well, no problem. You know, we can try to use intrauterine insemination or some techniques where we can put the sperm right in the egg. So don't worry about that. Oh, you don't have a husband. Well, no problem. We'll use donor sperm. And again, don't worry about the genetics. That doesn't mean it. Don't worry about it. We can still help you. Oh, you want to screen your embryos before we implant them to make sure that they don't have any? No problem. We'll take the cells out. If they look funky, we'll throw those embryos away and we'll just keep working until we get a good one. Oh, did you accidentally conceive quintuplets? Oh, I'm sorry about that. But no problem. We'll just have an abortion of a couple of them or maybe three, and that way you'll just have a singleton pregnancy. Don't worry about it. And you know that some of the abuses this leads to, I'm sure you all know the case of Octomom a couple years back, and then she was not married and I think already had six kids, and then, you know, add eight more, and you can see what happens here. And then the last question has come up recently. Oh, is your spouse dead? Oh, no problem. We will do posthumous assisted reproduction. And this is from the ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. This is from a month or two ago. And I saw this on the cover, and I couldn't believe it. Go ahead. Okay, next slide. And they say, gosh, you know, well, there are balancing complex issues here. But, gosh, the technology they use to do this is very similar to the standard IVF cycle. So it's not too hard for them. They just have some frozen sperm. You know, hey, let's just go ahead and let's just go and do it. And then I saw this recently on the NPR website. Gosh, this is coming to court now. Benefits from babies born after dad's death. Now, don't get me wrong. They were not even conceived when the dad was alive. The dad was dead, and then they were conceived. So I told the residents, I said, gosh, am I the only one that finds this a little bit humorous but very disturbing, that there are no limits? I mean, the IVF doctor that was speaking about IVF, I mean, her only ethical issue was, does the couple understand the risks and benefits of what we are doing to them? Nothing about the new life or family or anything else. Just do they understand what's going on? That's the only ethical issue that the whole IVF process seems to generate in their eyes. Go ahead. Of course, detaining pregnancy is only half the battle, and again, we discussed this selective reduction before. So now a little bit more about the philosophy and theology behind the church's position. Oh, go ahead.
You never said, did it make a dent in the students' minds?
our resident state people, I believe so. I mean, a lot of them I know personally are somewhat opposed to this. I mean, it is a Catholic hospital, and I think they all respect St. Peter's position, so I think they did see that. And a lot of them were shocked about that. I had only heard this, you know, posthumous assisted reproduction recently, and so I think, thankfully, a lot of them did kind of see, gosh, this is kind of just, this is strange, and this is not right.
Yeah, but if they don't have the money to pay for it, now they have a problem.
Yeah, exactly. One of the other ethical issues there. No, no, that's okay. So from a philosophical context, what begetting human life, if you look up begetting in the dictionary, beget means to procreate, maybe especially as a father, but to procreate. That's different from manufacture or produce. This is some of this material is from William May. He's a relatively well-known ethicist and theologian, and I think if... he publishes a great book called Catholic Bioethics and the Gift of Human Life. I highly recommend this if you just want a summary of the Church's teaching about sexual ethics. Anyhow, he articulates it much more eloquently than I could. When human life comes to be in and through the marital act, it comes as a gift crowning the act itself. The child is begotten through an act of conjugal love. He or she is not made or treated like a product. They do not make a baby just as they do not make love, for neither a human baby nor love are products that one makes. They are not making things, they are rather doing something, giving themselves to each other as irreplaceable and non-substitutable persons, complementing their sexuality and opening themselves to the gift of human life. Again, they are procreating or begetting a child through an act of love. They are not producing or making one. So from a philosophical angle, there are two modes, two different ways that of human activity. One is, the first is transitive, or making something. This is when an action proceeds from an agent, from a person, from us, and the interest centers on the product made. This is governed by the rules of art. Those products that don't measure up are discarded, and the action perfects or fails to perfect the product made. Example, baking cookies or cars or writing a poem. So we're making cookies. We're very interested on if these cookies taste good, if they look right, if they have the right number of chocolate chips, if people buy them. If we accidentally put too much flour in one, well, we can just throw those cookies out. Okay, that's fine. It's a very much a manufacturing kind of mode of acting. And that's fine if we're talking about baking cookies or cars or what have you. The other mode of human activity is eminence or doing. And this is more has a more moral context. The action abides in the acting agent, so within ourselves. It's governed by the virtue of prudence. And the interest centers on the acting agent, on ourselves. If the action is morally good, then it perfects the agent. It leads us to be more virtuous. If the action is bad, it leads us in the other direction. And through the action, an agent makes himself or herself the kind of person that he or she is. So an example is choosing. Every choice we make to make something involves a choosing. Well, gosh, why did you choose to make, why did you choose to write this letter instead of putting something else in your letter? Or why did you choose to have a child rather than choosing not to have a child? Or why did you choose to go to the pro-life conference rather than the pro-abortion conference? So every choice is an action within ourselves that leads us to be more virtuous or less. Many human activities involve both making and doing, both modes. A husband, he makes cars at the Ford plant down the road, and he doesn't like his work, but every day he goes there because he knows he's supporting his wife and family. So that's a good choice he makes to make cars, but also it's making him a better person inside because he's sacrificing for his family. However, the act of marital intercourse is an eminent act. And I think women are much more emotionally sensitive. How do you think a woman would respond if her husband came home from work and he said, "Honey, let's be together tonight. You know what? We're going to be really efficient about this. You know, last time we took 15 minutes. This time, let's get it down to 10. We're going to have, the maximum amount of pleasure. You better respond." I mean, what would a woman say to that? Obviously, women are very sensitive. They can tell. No, they don't want to be treated like a product, obviously. So... marital intercourse, it's an imminent act within ourselves. It's giving yourself in love to your spouse. That they're not trying to produce any kind of external object. It's something they do. They give love to each other by giving themselves bodily to each other and open themselves up to the gift of human life. When a human life comes to be in and through the marital act, we rightly say that the spouses are procreating or begetting. They're not manufacturing anything. Life is begotten, not made.
Kyle, is this also from Dr. May?
Yes, his book does have this in it. Yep. Now, from a theological context, we are made in God's image, obviously. Gosh, every Sunday at Mass, what's the creed? I believe in one Lord Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son, not manufactured, or Son of God, born of the Father before all ages, God from God, light from light, true God from true God. Again, begotten, not made. It's right there in the creed, right there in the creed. Now, again, this is from Humanae Vitae, and this is just a paragraph from there, but in general, gosh, Humanae Vitae was really emphasizing the church's stance against contraception, but we can definitely see that it is kind of all of one piece. When you start to split the marital act and to unitive and procreative, when you split those, the unity and procreation aspects of that, you kind of tend towards all these abuses that Humanae Vitae foresaw. And again, Dignitatis Personae, this is recently from the church's teaching. The origin of human life has its authentic context in marriage and in the family, where it is generated through an act which expresses the reciprocal love between a man and woman. It must be born of the fruit of marriage. By treating the human embryo as mere laboratory material, that's not dignified, essentially. Dignity belongs to every human single being, irrespective of the parents' desires. I was giving a talk like this once to a group of high schoolers. And one high schooler stood up and said, "How dare you say this? I was conceived through IVF. How dare you say this? Do my parents do something wrong? Am I less than a person?" And of course the answer to that is no, we're all people. You are a person. No matter how you were conceived, you're a human person and you have all that. No one can take your dignity from you. It's given to you by God, regardless if you're conceived through rape or marriage or boyfriend, girlfriend. It doesn't matter. But you know what? Your parents didn't respect you when they did that. And can anyone raise their hands and tell me that your parent is perfect? I don't see any hands, right? So it's okay, your parents weren't perfect, but they didn't respect you. Now, Virginia, you may have heard about this. The state of Virginia recently had an effort, I believe it was called the Human Personhood Act, or to define that life begins at conception. Okay? Now, I think this is a very common, if you ask an embryologist or any physician, I mean, the truth is life begins at conception. If you want to disagree with that, I think the burden is on you to prove that. And so people, oh, well, maybe it's implantation, or maybe it's when you have a brain, or when you don't look like a shrimp, or, no, come on. I mean, it's really ridiculous. I mean, they go through all these cartwheels to try to prove that it's not conception. And honestly, why is that? Obviously, because if we want to take the courage to define this and stand up by this, then we need to follow this to its logical conclusion and not do IVF and not use all these abortifacient medications that we have. But obviously, you don't seem to have the political will to get this done. Of course, go ahead, Les. All the IVF people, gosh, again, ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, oh, gosh, Virginia almost passed this law. Thank you for standing up and shooting it down. Gosh, else maybe we couldn't have our IVF. So that's very frustrating. One of the verses in the Bible that should scare all of us, and maybe gynecologists especially, is Matthew 25:40. Amen, I say to you, whatever you did for the least brothers of mine, you did for, or you did to me. And I can see maybe a modern reworking of this Bible passage where Jesus separates people on one side and the other and says, when I was an embryo in my mother's womb, did you protect me? That I was the smallest person then. What did you do to protect me? And people say, oh, well, we did IVF, we did all this, and when you did it to anyone else, you did it to me. So the bottom line is that we must respect the dignity of marriage and human life. And even if there are scenarios, and there are, where it may be impossible to conceive through any other means than IVF, I mean, I'm not going to get a woman who's 50 with no fallopian tubes and her partner with no sperm. I can tell them, gosh, your chance is near zero.
Yeah.
I probably won't help you, but, gosh, you go to an IVF doctor, donor egg, donor sperm, or whatever, surrogate motherhood, they will try to help you. Even if that's the only way, it's still unethical. It's not, in the end, it's not about efficiency or your chance of success. It's about we decide what's right to do first, and then we do it. Obviously, ART and IVF adopt a manufacturing process that involves many times creating life to destroy it. Is a child a gift or a right? You have to keep that in mind. Is it just like a new car I'm trying to get, or a new child with blonde hair and blue eyes and 6 foot tall? No, it's a human person. Any questions about that before I switch gears here? So NAPRT technology stands for Natural Procreative Technology, kind of pioneered by Thomas Hilgers, who Dr. Rubersberger mentioned, in Omaha, Nebraska. I had the pleasure of doing a one-year fellowship with him after my OBGYN training. He defines it as a new women's health science, which has as its main principle the ability to work cooperatively with a woman's menstrual and fertility cycles. It has applications in medical treatments, surgical treatments, prenatal kind of pregnancy care. Again, the philosophy of... In terms of infertility, the philosophy is exactly that of the church. We're attempting to optimize couples' fertility so they can conceive through an act of love. It's meant for all patients, although it's based on Catholic ethics. Now, originally, I know I'm kind of speaking to the choir on this, so I don't want to spend too much time on the family planning aspect of it, but originally, back in the 50s, when the Billings in Australia were coming up with the Billings method, you have cycles here, and you can see, in terms of family planning, obviously you have intercourse. If you want to get pregnant, you know, when you're ovulating, if you don't want to get pregnant, have intercourse anytime outside here. And that's originally what this was developed for. But then as time went on, we saw that different patterns crop up in different scenarios in women's health care. And Dr. Hilders started correlating this with labs and ultrasounds and surgical data and outcomes, and that's how the science of NAPRT technology came about. So in terms of infertility, what do we do here? Well, obviously we don't make use of IVF or insemination. We seek to identify and correct underlying conditions that might be contributing to infertility, endometriosis, tubal disease, infections kind of inside the uterus, ovulation problems, hormonal support problems in the cycle, subtle adrenal or thyroid conditions, cervical mucus problems, and so forth. Well, how do we do this? Well, gosh, we use the fertility care charting, the Creighton charting. We get hormonal blood draws. We look at how their follicle progresses on ultrasound. So many times we also do a surgical evaluation and so forth, ovulation induction, put fallopian tubes back together or reconstruct them, using other medications as a pump form sometimes. Again, anything we can do to optimize their chance of getting pregnant, attaining conception through an act of love. This next group of slides is from slides I show my patients in terms of, gosh, what is NAPRT technology and what do we do here? And there's kind of five, in general, in terms of an infertility evaluation, five main areas. Go ahead, Les. The first one is the charting. And just some of the things that go through my mind when I look at a client's charting, there's a lot of information we get around this. Gosh, we look at the cycle length. You know, cycles tend to shorten up as a woman ages in her reproductive life, and actually it can be more difficult to attain conception. If they have irregular cycles, obviously polycystic ovarian syndrome is something that jumps out. They may have no cycles and have problems with their brain in terms of regulating their ovulation. They may have a luteal phase defect in terms of the last part of their cycle, where maybe they're not making enough progesterone to support a pregnancy. In terms of, we look at their bleeding, and this is a relatively normal cycle here, but gosh, sometimes we see patterns that make us think they may have an inflammation inside their uterus, or even a hyperplasia or pre-cancer, or other problems they might have. We look at their cervical mucus, and you know, whereas other people go for intrauterine insemination, we try to take measures to improve their mucus, and there's a lot of things we can do. The mucus is also a secondary marker for the health of their follicles. Gosh, the same follicle in the ovary that makes estrogen also acts on the cervix to make this mucus. So they're related factors, so we can tell some other things about their reproductive health. We also use the cycles to monitor the response to therapy. We might put them on medications to stimulate their ovulation or the luteal phase and so forth. And we use the cycles to see how they're responding to that medication. This is a study published in the Green Journal, a very well-regarded journal in OBGYN, from Joe Stanford, who is an epidemiologist who's very involved in the Creighton method. And just showing here that, gosh, on their peak day, gosh, that's when you have the highest chance of pregnancy or conception. The next aspect is the laboratory aspect, the lab evaluation. And under every standard cycle should be an orderly progression of estrogen and progesterone. So we use this, and we don't draw their blood every day, but we take one cycle in the beginning of their evaluation where we get about 8 or 9 blood draws just to get an idea of those curves of estrogen and progesterone. And we can see, compared to what a normal curve should be, we can get an idea of what's going on with them. And Dr. Hildreth has identified what he thinks are several different categories of dysfunction during a woman's luteal phase after she ovulates. And gosh, of course, the IVF people have nothing like this. I mean, again, their thing is, oh, well, first we'll try intrauterine insemination. If that doesn't work, then we'll do IVF. I mean, they have basically lost interest in looking at underlying factors, and they go right for IVF. All their research is on how can we make IVF better. I mean, that's their research. The next step is ultrasound. And again, we take 1 month where we do a series of ultrasounds to see how their follicle is developing. And a follicle is that cyst of the ovary that grows every month, contains the egg. And we can gain a lot by looking at it and how it grows and does it rupture. How does the endometrial lining in the uterus, how does that lining look? Is that cervix dilating a little bit like it should? And so we can get lots of little ideas of what subtle things that might be wrong that might need addressed. This is actually can go back once. I did this in my fellowship. This is part of an ovary. I mean, the whole ovary is, well, you can't see all of it. This is the follicle inside the ovary, and this is the cumulus oophorus right here, which is a small little sac, if you will, that surrounds the egg. So the egg is right inside that little sac there. There's a 3D picture of it, so kind of cool what we can do now with ultrasound. Okay, got it. And then surgery, obviously. Now, I always tell my patients, gosh, we try to go from least to most invasive. And many times, you know, many couples can get pregnant without surgery, but some can't. And so we have recourse to surgery if we need to. These are some different surgical techniques and procedures we do. One is a hysteroscopy, where we look through a hysteroscope into a woman's uterine cavity to see if she has any polyps or adhesions or any evidence of endometritis. This is a relatively normal uterine cavity here, and these shadows, kind of the edges here, if you can see more clearly, you would see the ostia, or the little openings of the fallopian tubes into the uterine cavity. This is an example of a small endometrial polyp on one patient, and this is an example of quite a large endometrial polyp. And taking these out can improve fertility. This is a little machine here, a little morcellator that kind of chews up the polyp and takes it out. And you can see now it's gone. Another technique we do is something called a hysterosalpingogram. That's where we see if the fallopian tubes are open. And you can see here, this is just a standard HSG, and so there's a catheter here in the cervix that's pushing dye in through the uterine cavity, and you can see that dye going through the tubes and then spilling out around the lady's intestines and so forth. So we know, okay, gosh, that's good, the tubes are open. But we have something in addition we can do. If the tubes look blocked, we can do what's called a selective hysterosalpingogram. Or even if they're not blocked, we do this sometimes because, and you can't see this, here's a uterine cavity. You can see this kind of triangle here. That's the cavity. What you can't see is I have a catheter in here seated right where the tube meets the uterus, and I can measure the pressures in there. So even if it's open, well, that's great if it's open, but if there's a high pressure there, there might be maybe what's called a partial obstruction. Maybe there's some mucus or menstrual debris in that tube. And a high pressure implies a narrower channel. So I can clean that out with a little guide wire here. And sometimes maybe there's a small blockage there. And sometimes that guide wire can push past that and open it up. And then after I've done that, I retake the pressures. And most of the time, the pressure decreases. implying a larger channel and a greater chance that, that the sperm can get up there and meet the egg and attain conception. Laparoscopy is another procedure. That's where we make an incision in the belly button and put a camera through into a woman's abdomen, and we can make several other incisions down low and look and see what's going on, because the HSG can tell us what's going on inside the cavity and the tubes, but we can't see the outer surface. So sometimes, obviously, if a woman has a lot of pelvic pain or nodules on physical exam, or we know she's had a lot of past surgeries, she can have endometriosis or scar tissue that needs to be taken care of. And so this is how we can do that. This is a relatively normal picture. I hope some of these slides won't gross you out, but just let me know. There's some surgery photos here. So this is a woman's uterus here from the outside of laparoscopy. Here are fallopian tubes hanging down here. You can kind of barely just see the ovaries here. They're kind of tucked behind the tubes. And here's this is part of her sigmoid colon here coursing down this way. This is one example of a patient with a lot of scattered endometriosis lesions. Here, even some of them kind of on her intestines here. This is another one. The uterus is right here. Here's one of the ovaries, and here's her right fallopian tube. And this endometriosis was sticking the ovary to the sidewall and kind of gently splitting it away. Another example of endometriosis right here. Now, there's a lot of, if you read textbooks and things about endometriosis and fertility, endometriosis is a very frustrating disorder because you can almost find a different opinion, opposing opinions about it. You can almost find any opinion about endometriosis if you read enough articles. And not all studies agree, but the largest randomized study, so these studies are considered the best, found that they took all these, over 300 patients that had endometriosis. Half of them, they took out they treated the endometriosis. The other half, they just looked at it. And then they followed these patients and saw how they did in terms of pregnancy. And not quite double, but almost double the patients in the laparoscopic, the group where they took it out, got pregnant versus those that they didn't do anything. Now, obviously, it's not, and I tell my patients this, gosh, it's not 100% blocked to fertility. You can see patients in this group, they still got pregnant, but not as many and not as quickly as in the group where they took it out. Now, just a comment on this, and this is what I really, personally, I have to thank Dr. Hildreth for and the training I received with him. So I have a question for you, and the question is, what do all these women have in common that follow? So go ahead, Dr. Hildreth. So here's one picture, and if you look closely, or not so closely, you can see a little, take it from me, there's some abnormal tissue right here, and right here, and these little vesicles here. Okay, so that's one patient. The next patient, this is quite apparent here, and then some other lesions right here that are more subtle. And this one is not so subtle. I mean, you can see on her ovary some angry-looking lesions here, and then in other places as well. So the answer is, all these patients had endometriosis, but not only that, they all had prior laparoscopies with surgeons who told them that they didn't have endometriosis. And, you know, I've seen this a lot now, so it's not too shocking, but most shocking to me is one of these patients, her surgeon spoke at the World Conference on Endometriosis that I went to. And he was a very famous guy, and gosh, he did a great job on her laparoscopic myomectomy, but he missed that endometriosis. I think, gosh, if even a world expert is missing this, then that's why I don't trust all the literature on endometriosis. It might be a little bit skewed if we don't have good physicians who at least can do good diagnostic laparoscopies and look at it. So the correct diagnosis of an endometriosis is, if you will, operator dependent. It depends on the experience of the person doing the surgery. This is from Dan, and this is not even from Dr. Hildreth. This study here is from Dan Martin back in the 80s. He's a pretty famous endometriosis surgeon from Tennessee. And he published his experience through the 1980s, when we were learning to really identify the more subtle forms of endometriosis, he said, gosh, we used to diagnose, it used to be that 42% of our patients we looked at that had pain or fertility, 42% of them had endometriosis, where at the end of the study, we got more skilled at looking at it, diagnosing it, and up to over 70% of the patients who have fertility problems or chronic pelvic pain have endometriosis. And gosh, if you read literature about pelvic pain or infertility, they quote nowhere near these numbers. They say, oh, maybe 5 or 10% of patients have endometriosis. Well, I guess I don't agree with that, because you can find it. If you know what you're looking for, you will find it a lot more often. So let's talk about effectiveness now. We'll switch gears here. So IVF, well, does it work a lot? Well, it can work, but as you can see, and this is from the World Health, this is from the CDC. So everyone will quote these numbers. These are good numbers. They're essentially indisputable from, you know, if you talk to other IVF doctors. Most of the time, it doesn't work. I mean, most of the time, there's no pregnancy. And clinical pregnancy happens about 37% of the time. Now, of those patients that do get pregnant, what happens to them? Well, you know, about 16% have a miscarriage. 25% or so have twins or triplets or quadruplets or so forth. And about 56% have a single live birth. This is the age distribution of women who had IVF cycles in 2009. And you can see, you know, that most of them are about 35 or older, a large group. This is the percentage of cycles using fresh non-donor eggs that result in pregnancies and live births and so forth. So you can see for pregnancy, that I think is the most relevant outcome, is these triangles here. I'm sorry, live birth. That's the circles, and you can see that, gosh, if you do it on a younger woman, okay, she has more chance of success. Up to, a little bit over 40% of cycles sometimes can have a live birth with it. And obviously, this goes down with age, and by the time you reach 40, it's under 20, and then it just goes down sharply from there. So if you show women those tests, you say, gosh, a 40% chance, if you're 25 and I do this, you could get pregnant. Yeah, go ahead.
A quick question. What is endometriosis? What caused that?
Yeah, sure. So he said, what causes endometriosis? We were talking about a couple minutes ago. Well, that's a good question. No one has proven it. People used to think that, you know, endometriosis, it's called endometriosis because it looks similar to the endometrium, which is the tissue inside the uterine cavity. And so, because if you take these endometriosis, these lesions that you saw up there, I was showing to you, and you look at it under a microscope, it shares some features of the endometrial cavity. And so it was termed endometriosis. We thought, okay, it's just the endometrium tissue at an abnormal location. Now, that's a little bit simplistic looking at it. But so the question is, gosh, how does it get there? How does it get on the intestines or ovaries or outside the uterus? People used to think that it's from menstruating backwards through the tubes, right? Most menstrual tissue comes out through the vagina every month in the woman's menses, but some goes backwards through the tubes. But the problem is that we know, it seems that all women have some menses backwards through their tubes. But not all women have endometriosis. Also, it's my opinion, and the opinion of many people now, it's coming out, if it comes backwards through the tubes, it should be impossible to cure surgically. Because if I do a surgery for it, the next month she's just going to have more menses backwards through her tube, and she's going to get it again, so why bother to do surgery? But the truth is, surgically, we know that we can cure women from it. I'm still a little young in my career, but people who've been doing this for years, Dr. Hildreth, Dr. Redwine, there's a lot of names, they find on their second look surgeries, they go back in a second time, and up to 60% of those women have no evidence of endometriosis. It's all gone. So this concept is, oh, maybe it grows back. I think that really represents incomplete treatment of it or incomplete excision. That's my opinion. But did I answer your question? I don't know if I...
Yes. Is there any correlation between endometriosis and the pill?
In terms of causing endometriosis?
Yeah,
not to my knowledge. I mean, the pill is often used to suppress endometriosis. It can't get rid of it. But for some women, it can help their pain somewhat. I don't think it's the best medicine for it. I think it's the best to surgically excise it. But it can make those implants shrink a little bit. Any more questions on it? I guess we could talk for hours about endometriosis and how it's formed. It is a great interest of mine, but I can talk to you later about it if you have more questions. So this next slide, percentage of IVF cycles that this is in women over 40. So you can see, gosh, live birth, the light blue, it rapidly declines after 40. And this is just breaking it down by problems. What's your chance of having a live birth? And you can see various distributions of that. But again, if you go to an IVF doctor, they'll say, gosh, all right, here's your chances. Let's just go straight to IVF. You know, that's your... Now, interestingly, I've got to tell you this, too. All these techniques are published in medical journals that almost anyone has access to around the world. I mean, you can go to PubMed. I mean, so people in, you know, the Netherlands and the U.S., we all look at these articles. But IVF seems to be much more effective here in America than it does in Europe or other places. We have the highest pregnancy and live birth rates from IVF. And you got to ask, what is the reason for this? And the reason, in my opinion, the reason is, anytime you look at infertility stats, you got to be really careful. This stuff is hard to understand. I'll tell you that even though I read this stuff all the time, I don't profess to have a complete understanding of the statistical methods they use and how they manipulate. It's all about your population of patients. It's almost impossible, it is impossible, to have the exact same cohort of patients between two studies. It's just impossible. If a study shows superb effectiveness, you got to question, maybe that was an easy group of patients to get pregnant. Like I keep saying, in the U.S., we rapidly say, oh, just do IVF. So I think what's happening is, in the U.S., it's so pushed, and our clientele is relatively wealthy compared to other parts of the world. So in Europe, maybe in other places, they're only doing IVF on patients that are much harder to get pregnant, where here in the U.S., oh, you're 25 and haven't been able to get pregnant in two cycles? Come on, let's do IVF. And of course she's going to get pregnant. I mean, it's an easy one. So that's why, oh gosh, we're so great, we're so effective, when the truth is, you probably don't need IVF. You know, there are other things that we can do to help you conceive. So that's just my little thing on that. But so NAPR technology, what is the success rates on that? There's, you know, obviously, the proportion of fertility doctors who do NAPR technology is like this compared with everyone else who does IVF. So we don't have as much resources, we don't have as many studies, but we have some studies that we can look to. This is Dr. Hilder's own published data. Again, it's not peer-reviewed, which means it's not in a medical journal, and some people will try to shoot holes in it because of that. But, you know, it's one of the few pieces of data we have, so it's worth looking at. This is a series of over 1,000 of his patients, and this is over 4 years. And pregnancy rates of up to 70%. So, gosh, that's pretty good. And most of it happening within the first 2 years. Now, again, playing devil's advocate, this was a relatively young group of patients. And I forget the average age, but I believe it was about 31 or 32. So relatively young in terms of this type of data. But these patients had all different kinds of problems. Fallopian tube problems, endometriosis, polycystic ovaries. This is a couple years back. I went and tried to find the most effective IVF papers I could find versus NAPR technology. And these are two studies. One of them is from Boston, and this one's from Boston, and this one is from the Netherlands. And they published their live birth rates in couples after about, I think, 5 or 6 cycles of IVF. And after that many cycles, I know you can't, gosh, this didn't show up here, but this one is about 51%, and this, I think, is 58 or 59%. So, gosh, you know, 58, I'll have a take-home baby if I do this for 5 or 6 cycles. Now, versus Dr. Hilder's 71% pregnancy rate at 4 years. Now, this is not apples to apples. Some of these patients will have miscarriages, unfortunately. But I still think it's at least a very good alternative. If we knew the number that had miscarriages, I think it would still be on par with these. So I still think it's a very, it's up there. I can't prove it's better, but I think it's a very good, stack it up against the latest and greatest IVF. It still looks pretty good. This is another study, not of actual patients, but of calculations from the literature. And this is from Joe Stanford, and this is published in Fertility and Sterility, which is like, you know, pretty much the best fertility journal that that physicians think about. The light blue line is people doing IVF, and about, this is calculated after about 3 cycles. Okay, so a lot of patients will get pregnant. And then after that, I mean, you can't do IVF forever. It's so expensive, and your insurance then says no, and then you're done. And so your chances, you still could get pregnant on your own, which is ironic, but it does level off. So compared to more conservative treatments, meaning NAPR technology and those sort of procedures, what we do basically, that's that black line here. And you can see it's not as quickly effective, but as time goes on, it has a potential to be more effective. And if you look, this is very, very close to Dr. Hilder's pregnancy success rates. You know, again, up to about 70%. This is about 3 years. So very closely correlated to what we see in real life. Okay, good. This is an amazing study from Ireland. NAPR technology is used by providers throughout the world. This is from Phil Boyle in Ireland. And I gave this once to at St. Peter's at a different lecture, and someone said, oh, the Journal of American Board of Family Medicine, that's a throwaway journal. I mean, who would use that? And I'd say, gosh, you know what? It's one of the only, sure, you know what? Oh, fine. donate some money so we can get a good study and publish it in Fertility and Sterility. You know, I mean, it's one of the few pieces we have. We can learn from this and not like, gosh, if we only restricted ourselves to two or three journals that were the best, then we wouldn't know anything. Anyhow, so this is, again, over 1,000 couples, and this breaks down their success. What's so amazing by this, it breaks down their success by age group. Of course, it's harder to help couples conceive the older they get. The more time they have tried, they have been trying to get pregnant, it's more difficult. They're harder patients to help. But look down here, the previous ART, I mean, that means IVF, the previous IVF attempts. And even in couples who are failing IVF, he shows, gosh, I'm still helping these patients get pregnant and have live birth. These are live birth rates. Now, again, statistics are hard to understand. The crude proportion means that, okay, you look at all the live births you had. These are the percentage of live births we had. The adjusted proportion, that's if these couples had stayed in my program for the 2 years that I suggested, this is the estimated pregnancy rate. So, again, we have these two measures of efficacy. This is probably the safest one to use, and this one is a little more optimistic here. But other IVF studies will state their optimistic methods, so you know we'll state our optimistic methods as well. So if you failed one cycle of IVF, up 20 to 40% chance of getting pregnant. And that's amazing. And gosh, Phil Boyle, he's only a family practice doctor. He's had 3 years of education after med school, where IVF doctors have seven or more. So it's amazing he's getting these numbers. And you know, these patients are the hardest to get pregnant. And you know, you can, after you do IVF, if you read literature, they'll say, okay, you failed IVF. There's about a 5% chance you'll get pregnant if you do nothing else. If you just go home and do nothing else, 5% chance you'll get pregnant. But he's helping up to 40%. I mean, that's awesome. That's amazing. And also, the average age in this study was pretty high. It was over 35. So this is a relatively difficult group of patients to get pregnant. So this is a great study. Any questions on that?
Yeah,
that's a great question, Teresa. Obviously, you know, IVF, they're plagued by multiple pregnancies, by ovarian hyperstimulation that can be harmful to women. And even if they get a singleton pregnancy, there's data coming out now that those children have more health problems compared with spontaneously conceived children. And, you know, we can think about what all this means, and gosh, maybe sometimes, for whatever reason, a couple is not meant to have a pregnancy, just genetically, or however you want to say that. Maybe God doesn't want them to, you could say that. And we're kind of trying to force the issue, and this is maybe shades of what's happening here sometimes. So that's a very good thought. So now I'm going to tell you about some specific cases we've had here at the Jonas Center in New Jersey. Case number one, this is a 29-year-old neuro intensive ICU nurse, referred from another provider for a surgical evaluation. She had primary infertility for 3 years. She had polycystic ovarian syndrome, and she had already had 5 cycles of ovarian stimulation, and she was unable to conceive. So we took her for a laparotomy, like a C-section incision, and did an ovarian wedge resection. And she actually recently delivered their newborn, and she got pregnant from a pregnancy. She conceived about 3 or 4 cycles after surgery. And PCOS, one of the problems is, you know, the ovaries are enlarged here, and I don't want to get all into it. We could talk again a long time about this, but there's a dysfunctional hormonal situation in the ovaries. If we take out a wedge of the ovary, that can improve that hormonal function, cause them to cycle normally, and then they have an increased chance of getting pregnant like she did. So case number two, kind of a similar situation, although this lady, again, polycystic ovarian syndrome, insulin resistance, which means that kind of like a pre-diabetic state in this lady. She had been trying for 7 years. Again, this is a pretty, you know, that alone is like, gosh, okay, this is going to be a harder patient to help conceive. She'd already had 8 cycles of Clomid to try to cycle her, but no success. This is the first lady I did a laparoscopic wedge resection on. I used to do it always through a large incision. and I'm always trying to advance my laparoscopy skills, and so I did a laparoscopic wedge resection on her. I also gave her some luteal phase support, some mucus enhancers, and naltrexone, which is another medication we use sometimes. And thankfully, she got pregnant the third cycle after surgery, and now she's about 24 weeks pregnant. This is a picture, a laparoscopic picture of her ovaries. Not only were they enlarged and polycystic, but they were scarred to the sidewalls here. So sorry if it's grossing out, but we had to split them away and, you know, kind of protect the vessels and ureters that are under the ovary, and take a wedge-shaped chunk out of them, and then sew them back together, and that's what we did for her. So thankfully, she was able to conceive. Case number three, a 30-year-old with 3 years of primary infertility. She had a prior hysterectomy. I'm looking at her tubes that one of her tubes looked like it was blocked right where it met her uterus. They didn't see any dye go down there. Her husband had a very poor semen analysis. Zero normal morphology, which means that, you know, they look at the sperm under a microscope, and none of them look like they all have two heads, or they look kind of funky, and so, oh gosh, it doesn't look too great. Now, I got to say something about this, too. And this patient, she was referred to me from another provider as well. But the people that do IVF, they have over time, gosh, any man's sperm, a lot of the sperm will be abnormal, but there are millions and millions and millions, so even if they're just 40% normal, that's great because there's so many millions of them. That's kind of how God made it to be. But they've made the grading scale now. It's subjective. They've made it so strict so they can say, oh, look, none of your sperm are normal. You need IVF. That's the only way you'll get pregnant. So I think there's a lot of this going on. And so, of course, they told her, gosh, honey, you know, the only way you're getting pregnant is IVF. Don't even think of doing anything else. So she came to us. She did have some pelvic pain. She'd never had a laparoscopy before, so I took her for a laparoscopy. She had stage 3 endometriosis and left tubal obstruction. Now, she had a proximal obstruction where the tube meets the uterus, and every diagnostic test has its limitations. And we can reimplant the tube into the uterus, but I always like to confirm this with a second test. So I repeated that tubal study test and found that now the right side was blocked and the left side was open. So I thought, oh gosh, that's kind of strange. Obviously, you know, something's going on here. I think they both are open, but I just can't. It's something's going on weird here. So I did the surgery. I took out her endometriosis. She had stage 3, which is almost the worst. Now, this lady, as I was talking to her family after the surgery, I said, gosh, her surgery went very well. And her mother is like, gosh, well, thank you for doing that surgery, Dr. Bider. You know what? I just think that she needs to relax. She's always so tense and uptight. And I just told her for years, she just needs to relax. And I started thinking about that. I thought, gosh, she's having some kind of spasm of her tubes. And, you know, your uterus is not like your arm muscles. You can't, you know, control it like that. But something's going on here. And so I told her referring provider, I said, you know, I don't know. She's got this reversal obstruction. I have not done this before, but I think you should give her something to relax her during when she's trying to conceive. You know, maybe we can make her tubes open. I mean, there's certain agents that can relax the uterus. I was thinking of magnesium. Sometimes calcium channel blockers can as well. This provider, she decided to use a Valium-like drug, which is fine. It's not, we use this all the time. But lo and behold, she got pregnant, you know, 3 cycles after surgery. And again, this is someone that, this is just kind of an anecdotal story to show that, gosh, we really try to think about what's going on in these patients and help them out. Everyone else is saying, gosh, you need IVF. There is no way you're going to get pregnant. Where if we take a little bit of care and dedication to these patients and think about it, we can sometimes help them to get pregnant. Now, unfortunately, she had a miscarriage. And that's, you know, that is a problem of all assisted reproduction, but or infertility therapy. But I think they're still trying, and hopefully they can conceive again. Case number 4, 39-year-old primary infertility, attending conception for 2 years. So she's a little bit on the older side in terms of success. 2 failed cycles of insemination. Referred to me from another provider. Laparoscopy, we found endometriosis on her fallopian tubes on kind of the delicate part. This is the nodule here. And endometriosis doesn't really usually look like this. I mean, usually it's not. Usually you can have cysts of it on the ovaries a lot more often than on the tubes like this. So we cut that off there, and this is a tube afterwards. You can see where it was. And she got pregnant, and actually she recently delivered her child. So another example of another success story for us. Go ahead, Les. And this This is the last example I'll show you about. A 35-year-old woman, 44-year-old husband. First pregnancy was by IVF. After that, she wanted to get pregnant again. She had two failed IVF cycles and two failed insemination cycles. She was missing one fallopian tube from a prior surgery for an ectopic pregnancy. Again, and tried to conceive since their first child born in 2008. Everyone else would say, gosh, you need IVF. I mean, even IVF hasn't helped you. Gosh, you're going to be very hard to get pregnant. So I gave her some ovulation stimulation with gonadotropins, which is they're very powerful for medications for ovulation stimulation. We gave her some other things to help her, and man, she still wasn't getting pregnant. And after about the fourth cycle or so, I said, "Gosh, I kind of think maybe we need to do another laparoscopy. I don't know if you have some scar tissue after your surgery." But as soon as I said that, lo and behold, she got pregnant her fifth cycle, and now she's about 20 weeks pregnant and doing fine. So. You know, just an example of, you know, we try to start low invasive first and work up, and lo and behold, it is effective. Patients do get pregnant. So by way of conclusion, I hope you'll have taken from this that unfortunately mainstream medicine considers IVF to be the gold standard. However, as we've seen, it's really not an ethical approach to fertility. NAPRA technology is an ethical, effective approach that respects the dignity of women, marriage, the family, and new human life. And obviously in all this, you know, infertility is very frustrating because we don't know, for any given infertility patient, we don't know the difference. Maybe these women are conceiving, but the embryo is not implanting. That is thought to be a very big problem. Even in IVF, we know we're putting the embryos in there in IVF, and we know that most of the time they're not implanting. That's a huge problem. So if we had a test where we could tell a difference between those who aren't conceiving versus those who are conceiving but not implanting, that would be very useful. I don't know if we ever will have an answer to this. And, maybe some of this is as God intends because, gosh, He is the author of human life. This is actually an amazing scanning electron microscope view of an embryo kind of implanting. I don't know how they got this. And probably, it is kind of frustrating. That's a new human life there and obviously now passed away. But anyhow, He's the author of life. The beginnings of human life are mysterious. They always will be. And again, we're not going to know sometimes what exactly is going on. But we'll sure try the best we can to optimize these patients and increase their chances. Sometimes I'm surprised at those who conceive. And that, I can tell a patient, I think, in general, what their success rates might be. But sometimes I'm surprised. And I think it all goes to show that, gosh, God is the author. He's in control. And we need to respect that. So I want to thank you all for your time. And take any questions. Maybe. I mean, if you read all the textbooks and say that, gosh, after you discontinue the pill, you'll have no problem getting pregnant. But, yeah, anecdotally, in clinical experience, we see a lot of patients that they're on the pill and then they don't have regular cycles afterwards. That could be due to a number of things.
I guess I mean more environmental in general.
So you're saying, gosh, all these, right. And it's true. We can say, gosh, all these women on the pill, gosh, they all urinate and byproducts of the pill go into the water system and do our sewer systems filter those hormones? Well, they're not really meant to, and to what degree do they? So you're right, and that may be. There may be a link there.
What's the percentage of women that are infertile, you know, that want to conceive?
Right. Surprisingly, that number is coming down, and at least according to Spiroff, which is the best regarded. In the past, it's been about 12% in the recent past. And now I think, gosh, they say the latest numbers are a little bit lower than 10%, which is surprising because demographically, a lot of people are waiting to get older until they try to have kids. So that's kind of surprising to me, but that's what they say. So if you read textbooks, you'll see about 12, 10%.
And one more question. My husband and I do pre-canine. A lot of the couples are in their 30s and come through pre-canine because they, you know, want to have everything. My concern is that some people, they want to do what the church teaches, but they really don't have value of a marriage. When you see patients, do they come alone? Are their husbands involved?
Yeah. Right. Maybe one answer to your question is we have patients that come, and obviously infertility is very stressful. So we can see they're anxious. They come in the office, and my nurse Jamie Johnston and my ultrasound tech Amy Sherlock, they are my crate model instructors, and so they'll start learning the method with them, and you'll see over time that, gosh, that they seem to after they learn the model. Of course, we emphasize the relational aspect of it as well. They just seem to be, even though there's still some of them still struggle with infertility, they seem happier and they seem to brighten up a little bit. So maybe what we're doing is opening them up to the purpose of it. At least that's our hope. Again, it's an act of love. Not just we hope you get pregnant. That's what we're trying to do. But regardless, it's an act of love with your husband or wife. And we hope that what we're doing is helping them to realize that. So I think some of the times it is, and we can help them with that. Well, yeah, I mean, that's, sorry about that feedback. Yeah, that is a very good question. And, one of the things with ovarian hyperstimulation, which can happen, is that it can be very dangerous. If they overdo it, it can be very dangerous for women, something called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, where they have fluid balance shifts in their body. They can end up in the intensive care unit. They can pass away. I mean, that's pretty infrequent, but it can happen. Even if that doesn't happen, still, there's a very good question. I don't know if there's any long-term studies, to my knowledge, addressing that issue in terms of, gosh, do they undergo menopause sooner? Are they less likely to get pregnant? I don't know if there's any studies addressing that. That's a very good question. I mean, with this ovarian aspiration, again, most of the time these physicians do a lot. They can do it relatively safely, I guess, but if they hit a blood vessel or have some kind of complication, that can cause problems, and I've heard of that happening. So that can be a problem. And you're right, the body parts for sale, for example. We've got to be very vigilant about this.
Okay. How do you respond to single women who request this care, either cohabiting or otherwise? How do you
Right. Well, they know up front. Our staff reads patients when they call in. They have a little thing they read patients saying that, gosh, we are a Catholic medical center. We're fine to treat any underlying health problem you have personally. In terms of infertility therapy, we will only do infertility therapy if you are married, because we're a Catholic. So they know up front, so I don't have anyone coming in that has a false expectation. So,
Two quick questions, both about on the theme of how much success are you having in spreading the word about your research. One, you kind of alluded a few times in your presentation about the issue of what journals you publish in. So I'm interested in knowing how much success you and your colleagues have publishing in mainstream peer-reviewed journals, what the issues there are. And two, about recruitment and how many people are like you going to Omaha and
doing residencies and things. Yeah. Well, the first question, I never have published something in a big, huge peer-reviewed journal. I hope to someday, but Dr. Hilder sure have, and other people have. And just from speaking with him, there is some resistance. I mean, it's political, as everything is. And, the authors, many times the editorial board of these journals, they're big into IVF and contraception. So they're not always interested in something that sheds a negative light on what they like to do. So
is there enough out there that, in theory, a mainstream doctor should know about this? Or is it somehow still hidden in such a way?
There's a lot out there in support of it, but if you're not looking for it, you could ignore it. I mean, that's a quick hit. And the second one, seeing that, when I was going through training, and especially Dr. Ruseberg back in the day, there was almost no one except for, but now there's more and more. And, I spoke with someone the other day who said, gosh, there's all these email lists. Maybe there's about 50, it seems, OBGYNs perhaps in the country who are FP only. That's just very rough estimate. So I could take maybe one more question. Bob?
You're located in New Brunswick. For people who need your type of services, where are the other locations?
We're right in New Brunswick. There are a lot of other family practice physicians around, yourself included. And Dr. Rubensberger here, and OBGYN here in Bucks County. Dr. Jean Golden-Tebald is in Pittstown. Dr. Marianne Brinjar is in Macungie. Help me not to forget anybody.
Holy Spirit Hospital.
Holy Spirit Hospital, yeah, Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Who am I forgetting? There's pointing.
Dr.
Tiansen in Philadelphia, right? And she is right. She's right here. There she is. Dr. Tiansen. Who else? I'll mention his name. Dr. Robert Graby used to be an IVF doctor, but now he doesn't do NAPR technology so much, but he's NFP only. So there are people around. If you look on the websites, in the NFP network websites, you can find people. One last thing I'll say, gosh, St. Peter's, my organization, my hospital, employed me. They're thinking about making an outreach of the Giana Centers into Philadelphia. So we're very excited about this. We're having kind of an informal planning meeting after this conference today. So feel free to hang around. Someone from St. Peter's will be coming to discuss with us these opportunities. So that's great news. I think we're all very happy about that. So please don't hesitate to I'd be happy to speak with you all afterwards if anyone has any more questions. And thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you.